welcome to another episode of New Books and Poetry. I am your host, John Ebersole, and I am delighted to be joined by Daniel Tiffany, whose latest book is My Silver Planet, A Secret History of Poetry and Kitsch. Daniel, welcome to New Books and Poetry.
Thank you, John. I'm really happy to be talking with you. Thank you.
Well, it's great having you. Let me get right to it. What is Kitsch, and maybe get into how it was viewed by 20th century modernist critics, somebody like a Clement Greenberg. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, kitsch is, I think, you know, is a term, an aesthetic category or term that was defined by modernists in the 20th century, and it was usually, you know, it was seen as you know, positioned by Clement Greenberg and others. His essay is the most famous, but Herman Broek, who wrote an essay that influenced a lot of people, Walter Benjamin, and other people, and it was basically defined as a, you know, as something that was the antithesis to a kind of modernist formalism, and the definition, you know, the discussions of it and the definitions were really hostile and contemptuous. And they, you know, they associated it with, on the one hand, with romanticism or, in other words, with something that preceded industrial production, and then on the other hand, associating it with sort of modern industrial forms of production and reproduction. So there was a kind of confusion about what its origins were from the beginning, and even what it was often confused with camp. And so, but in any case, you know, they, for us, you know, the way most people think of kitsch, it's associated with material culture, with things and little tchotchkes and furnishings and so one of the, I guess the thing that really motivated the book was noticing as I was reading these essays by various modernists that were written mostly in the 20s and 30s. There were a number of people, including Benjamin and Adorno in the Frankfurt School, and then Herman Brook and Clement Greenberg. And I began to notice that they all mentioned poetry as an important source for kitsch.
Yes.
But that poetry seemed to have, in most people's minds, and in the discussions about kitsch, say in the 60s when the idea was revived in Wiz, that there was no mention of poetry at all, and I thought that was kind of odd. So, you know, so that's where I, that's sort of a very sketchy sort of history of the term and where it came from. You know, and it was associated with fakery and sentimentality and triviality. It was a kind of fake art. So that's a kind of, you know, kind of working definition of it. And then, you know, the impetus for the book to me, which was to find out what poetic.
Right. I think the book, and I think you do an amazing job of seeing how kitsch actually kind of changes our understanding of the development of modern poetry. And you particularly start focusing in on the ballad. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing was that I discovered in starting to look at a, you know, what I call a poetological version of kitsch. In other words, thinking of what kitsch is from the perspective of poetry, was that not only that it looked somewhat different than the formulation of kitsch as something that solely relates to material culture or objects, or furnishings, but that it was much older than the kind of the discussion and the terms and the tensions that gave rise to, you know, this antithesis between modernism and kitsch. When you look at poetry, it was much older and more idiosyncratic. So one of the things that became very clear with the book was that the book is not an attempt to sort of assimilate notions, or res, you know, echo ask poetry to somehow resemble presumptions or definitions that we have about kitsch in relation to material culture, but to see, to develop a sense of what poetic kitsch and see how it alters our sense of what kitsch is, kitsch defined in terms of material culture. So the way that I did that, the way that I sort of grounded the discussion about poetic kitsch as opposed to kitsch in general or kitsch as a category of material culture was by, you know, it began to be obvious to me as I looked at early discussions of popular poetry or what was called popular poetry in the early 19th century, that the discussion always circled around the question of the ballad, which was essentially the form of song and vernacular poetry that at a certain point became very fashionable in British literary culture and was imported into elite poetry. So there's something called the ballad revival, which is the moment in British the history of British poetry when elite poets become aware of and become interested in ballads, and it begins to emerge in the early 18th century, around the first decade or two of the 18th century. And most of the ballads they were called border ballads because they came from, most of them were collected and gathered from the border area between Scotland and England. And almost as soon as those things began to appear in literary journals, Addison in The Spectator had an early piece on ballads and that had a big impact. And almost as soon as they began to appear in sort of educated elite culture, there was this, tremendous kind of infatuation with them. And at the same time, they were almost immediately scandals and questions about their authenticity and about things being faked and that things were being fraudulent versions of things or things that were completely made up.
Yeah, you do a great. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so that what one of the arguments that I make is that the associations between kitsch and fakery, mm-hmm. or kitsch and fraudulence, or kitsch is a kind of fake art, are actually rooted in real events of counterfeiting poetry and faking these ballads. So that the sort of vague notion that kitsch is a kind of fake art is actually rooted in real sort of moments of literary scandal and literary fraudulence. So that there's a very concrete version of this kind of fakery. There's a long way in which the ballad becomes, and especially the refrain, mm-hmm. which is the aspect of the ballad that really becomes part of elite poetry that wasn't really a very common feature in elite poetry and educated poetry. And it was the refrain was one of the features of the ballad that were brought into elite poetry through this long process of ballad imitations and things. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of follow that all the way up through, kind of surprising moments where Pound in the Imagist Manifesto talks about that one of the things that you should do as an imagist is learn how to imitate ballads. And Pound himself wrote, a number of ballads, in this kind of archaic.
Mm-hmm. And you even say, I think at one point that, it would be considered almost blasphemous to some by associating Pound with kitsch.
It would be what?
Blasphemous.
Yeah. I mean, Pound and Imagism as the archetype of Anglo-American poetic modernism, and yet for many of those poets in that moment, Eliot and H.D. and a number of other poets, their early work, looks very much like, the poetry of the late, the fin de siècle sort of decadence And, you know, they were all struggling to sort of modernize themselves. And for Pound, it was clear that that was, in, you know, a kind of an aborted kind of process, that he was only able to do that successfully to a certain extent. That his own early poetry was steeped in sort of Victorian, you know, ballad imitations and a preoccupation with diction and translation and archaism and stuff, so that he never really was able to expel from his from his, you know, his poetry or poems. So it's really making an argument, at least in relation to Pound, that to really see Pound's modernity in your modernism, you have to see it in conjunction with this attachment to the other kinds of this other kind of work.
Yes, as you were teasing out this bridge between elite and the vernacular, you spent quite a lot of time on the Walpole and Shenstone set. Is there? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, the reception of ballads in the 18th century, one of the most enthusiastic and productive responses to them, and really the kind of first responders and were a couple of groups of sort of homosocial friendships, circles of men, poets, that one of them was centered around the poet William Shenstone, and the other, as you say, around what's his name, the other figure that you mentioned.
Oh, Walpole.
Yeah, Walpole. And those were it was in these circles that the earliest sort of formulations of Gothic began to take shape.
Right.
before the first Gothic novel. So one of the things that, and there was a, and Gothic itself is a kind of, is a kind of response to the recovery and the sort of scandal surrounding certain counterfeit ballads that occurred first, earliest in poetry rather than, I mean, you know, Gothic, the Gothic sensibility is usually associated with novels and with plays, but it actually first began to emerge in poetry, which is one of the aspects of it, along with melodrama, that feed into the kitsch sensibility. So, and these figures, you know, were both elevated, but also marginal figures because of their sexual orientation, and so there's an important kind of correlation between what's generally in the literature called imposture, which is both a social and aesthetic practice. Imposture,
right,
was the way that was the term that was used to talk about these fraudulent ballads, and at the same time there was a kind of imposture that was going on in terms of the sexual identities and the social profiles of the men in these circles, who were the earliest and most passionate adherents of ballad culture. Thomas Gray is probably the best, you know, the most famous of the poets.
Yeah. You called your book My Silver Planet a secret history. Why Silver Planet, and what makes it a secret?
Well, you know, it's a secret because poets generally, even though I think the aesthetics of kitsch are something that have worked their way into and been embraced or turned, let's say, in visual culture and kind of advanced visual culture. I mean, Warhol would be an example of it. But, you know, poets really don't like to talk much about kitsch. I mean, you know, describing somebody's work as kitsch in poetry is one of the worst things you could possibly say.
Right.
Even in relation to poets who consider themselves to be, you know, experimental.
Right.
You know, friendly to popular culture, et cetera.
Yes.
So, you know, so it was secret because people just, although it became clear to me that poetry was essential to the, you know, the kind of formulation of Kitsch, that poetry had never really discussed that aspect, its role in the formulation of Kitsch, and also realized that poetry in some ways is implicated in the origins of this tension between popular and elite cultures in the context of poetry. So that the tension between elite and popular cultures first takes place in the context of poetry, and specifically in a kind of struggle over control of the vernacular by various kinds of competing.
Yeah, I think that's what makes the book so ambitious, and your argument so compelling is connecting it to poetry. And speaking of, you're a poet yourself. Can you speak a little bit how these more scholarly ideas inform your work as a poet?
My work as a critic or a theorist tends to be pretty provocative and even perverse in certain ways. In other words, it pushes the limits of what, you know, certain kinds of comfort zones about the way people want to talk about poetry. And by people, I mean poets, and scholars, but especially, poets. And so, you know, my sense of my activity as a theorist is that, you know, that I find that most criticism or a lot of criticism about poetry is in a sense, not really very, I mean, one wouldn't describe it as provocative or experimental. I mean, the kinds of ideas that it entertains, that it usually stays within certain kinds of discourses, certain kinds of comfort zones, even though they may, you know, have they may be profiled as a kind of radicalism, whether it's Marxist or other kinds of radicalism, but ideas which are really uncomfortable about poetry and experiments that really involve potentially a kind of degradation of poetry or a kind of abandonment of really cherished kinds of relationships of poetry. A kind of unadulterated love, affection, or passion for it on the part of poets sort of doesn't really get pushed very far because of the protectiveness that many poets feel about poetry.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see my theory as a kind of experiment in the way that poets think about experimentation in their poetry, which is to say, there are lots of poets that embrace a kind of radicalism in their practice, but certain ideas and questions are sort of off, you know, are sort of off the table in ways. So one of the things that, you know, that I wanted to explore was a model of a relationship to poetry that involves, you know, something like what C.N. Nye calls, you know, certain kinds of ugly feelings, that our relationship to poetry is a compound of, you know, that there are certain kinds of poetry that make us deeply uncomfortable and, you know, which end up being, let's say, they end up involving, like Kitsch, a combination of disgust and pleasure or contempt. And pleasure. I mean, contempt being a kind of disgust that's directed towards things that are seen as largely harmless, but they're still sort of disgusting. So to me, it was really interesting, her notion of thinking about new kinds of aesthetic categories that are almost inevitably and a compound of different kinds of affects, where what you feel about certain kinds of art is it's deeply disturbing. It's a combination of, you know, of pleasure and you know, all the things that we associate with aesthetic experience, but that it also involves certain kinds of really negative affects or ugly feelings.
Definitely.
Kitsch is one of those. And to me, you know, work that really matters, I mean, of course, like any lover of poetry, there are poems that I just, you know, love without any, you know, any reserve or those kinds of feelings are really precious to me, but at the same time, the work that seems to be most affecting to me is work that is really deeply disturbing,
right,
and at the same time exciting, and things that I can't understand, and to put me in a position where I can't resolve my responses to it.
Exactly.
Kitsch seems to be one of those things. So So the sort of the secret planet had to do, you know, the secrecy of it had to do with trying to engage with certain kinds of taboos, certain kinds of doors that you know often remain closed. And the planet, you know, the it's a phrase of Keats, so it comes from Keats, who is often seen as a kind of paradigm, is identified by Greenberg and others as a kind of paradigm of poetic pitch.
Right.
Even though one of the things that I do in the book is I make it very clear that romanticism, that the, you know, the foundation of pitch in poetry has to be pushed back, you know, a century into the 18th century, and that the foundations of, even though it's an important feature of romanticism, but that it has to be pushed back. So on the one hand, it's about Keats, and it's also the idea of silver, which is something that there's this kind of thread that I developed in the book, silver as a kind of substance, which
yes.
One can talk about in relation to Kitsch.
Daniel, let me ask you, where were you born and raised, and how did you get involved in poetry?
I was born and raised in California. I grew up in the Bay Area. And on the peninsula, and I was involved in the theater for a long time when I was a kid. I went to Juilliard when I first got out of high school in New York, and then I left New York and didn't finish what I was doing at Juilliard, and sort of left the theater behind and moved to Europe and lived and worked in Paris and other places for about 4 years, picked up some languages, and then came back and went to Santa Cruz. I was a classics major, studied Greek and with Norman O'Brien at Santa Cruz. So I sporadically was in and out of Santa Cruz, and then finally got my degree in translation studies there, Italian and Greek and French.
And is this something your family was involved in at all, this field of study, or is this, you just sort of fell into it?
Yeah, it just, you know, it was just like, no, it wasn't anything, you know, it wasn't anything that my family wasn't cultivated or literary in any way. It was just, I mean, part of it was a combination of reading Pound. My first critical book is on Pound, and the way that, you know, a lot of young poets respond to his exhortations to read Greek and read Italian, and I took it fairly seriously. So, and then, you know, living in Europe for quite a while, which was more of just traveling and working.
No, that's great. You mentioned Pound. I want to return to him for a moment, since you have an entire chapter on him. You talk about nationalism, anti-Semitism, redundancy, triviality, irrational authority. Can you say some last words on Pound and his relationship to Kitsch?
the chapter is called Kitsching the Cantos, and it basically, you know, picks up a thread from the book, the first critical book that I did, which was on Pound, that Harvard published in 1995. Which is called Radio Corpse, which looks at Pound's early pre-Imagist and sort of the period of during Imagism, the teens, and looks at a kind of ubiquitous necrophilia in his poems. That when you look at the collected early poems, which collects his first six books, about half of the poems are kind of obsessed with ghosts and corpses.
Right.
And that's all a symptom of his sort of involvement in decadence and late 19th century aestheticism. And so I sort of track that forward through into the cantos and try to track the ways in which certain kinds of pitch that are associated with Orientalism, with medievalism,
right,
two primary kind of territories of poetic pitch, how they persist in towns in the cantos, and also the ways in which his idea of the persona, of the personae poems,
the persona itself or translation,
right,
which are really intimately related, how they end up being a way for him of smuggling into the cantos long after he's ostensibly left that early sort of decadence behind. It's a way of sort of smuggling into the cantos certain kinds of diction, that is to say, smuggling in through translation, under the aegis of translation, certain kind of archaic and pre-modernist, stuff that he just can't bear to get rid of.
Sure.
So it's about a way of enriching, of talking about how ballad poetry is something that persists and found, and how its relationship to popular culture.
Yep.
And trying to open up ways of reading the cantos that are less, constrained by certain kinds of modernist paradigms or frameworks.
Yeah, you follow that thread further into the 20th century with New Dada and Kitsch. Can you talk about how Kitsch expressed itself in the New York school?
There was an interest in counterfeit poetry and stealing poetry. Ted Barrack especially, but a number of other figures who, including Ashbery, and the most sort of visible, dominant figure of this, who, for whom borrowing and stealing and mimicking other poets is really essential part of the practice. And so I wanted to try to organize that, or I wanted to try to see that through a different kind of lens, rather than seeing it as a kind of an extension of modernism, trying to see it as an extension of a different kind of modernism that involves Kitsch. All of this is in the book. I'm sort of just rehearsing here.
Much better said
in the book.
No, you're just, it is great. Tell me a little bit about the process of just writing the book and putting it together. My dog is going crazy in the background. It's crazy. How'd you sort of catch on to this, the topic of Kitsch and diction in particular? And how did this book slowly come about? Like, how do you physically put this book together? Do they start out as kind of independent essays and they just sort of cohere?
The impulse for it really grew out of, in part, the critical book before it was called Infidel Poetics, and it's a book about obscurity, poetic obscurity, in relation to certain kinds of vernacular poetry. And my own poetry is something that is really embedded in a preoccupation with different registers of diction, a kind of Florafian playing and sampling and orchestrating and tuning of certain kinds of different registers of diction. So, I had published probably, in 2010, I published a couple of books of poetry, the Provado with Action Books and The Dandelion Clock, with Tim Fish. And in both of those books, emerge out of a kind of method that has to do with orchestrating different registers of diction and different sources that I'm sampling. So the Kitsch book, I identify the problem of diction as the essential feature of what marks poetic Kitsch, what makes Kitsch in poetry distinctive as opposed to other things that might link it to Kitsch in visual or material culture. So the way that you can tell what's distinctive about poetic Kitsch is its diction, ranging from various kinds of poeticism, archaism, to language that we think is prototypically poetic. So the impulse, the attention, the diction really came out of my, you know, my work as a poet.
Right. And I wanted to ask you, sorry to interrupt, but I was thinking about the essay that you published in Boston Review and the vigorous response to it. Can you talk about your feelings about that essay and the response to it?
I mean, as often happens with my critical books, it seems like there's an essay, something that I write immediately following it, which seems to get it right before the book gets it all wrong. A kind of coda that I think, you know, if only I had, you know, I'd be able to, you know, see this or think through this or
right.
Somehow. But, you know, but the essay was really, you know, there was an element in the book that, you know, grounds the problem of pitch and class conflict. And
right.
The diction of pitch is something that situates itself in certain kind of conflicts between elite and vernacular poetries. So I make that point, and I mention it in certain ways in my Silver Planet, but I didn't really engage with it, you know, in a very polemical way. I didn't really ground it in certain kinds of sociological or Marxist sort of theory about class.
Sure.
So I decided I was going to do that, and I wanted to do a piece that really outlined, formulated the sort of class, the context of class, and the problem of class theory in the contemporary world, and in the context of Occupy and all the, you know, the memes about inequality and the meme of, you know, the 1% and then the 99%, which
right.
is class identities and class conflict. So, you know, I wrote this essay that put Kitsch in that context, in more directly and polemically in the context of class conflict. I knew it was polemical, but I didn't realize that, I saw it in some ways, politically and poetically, as on the one hand being, you know, engaged in certain kinds of issues that friends and people that I read in terms of contemporary Marxist work, you know, whether it's the Oakland community, the British community of Marxists. So I saw it as engaging in their in dialogues that I
right.
am reading on the political side of it, on the sort of poetic side of it. I saw it as something that was a way of speaking to the politics of FLARF and trying to talk about FLARF, which is something that interests me, and I admire a lot of poets that do that kind of work. And, you know, what I found was, because in some ways I'm not part of either of those communities. I mean, my work is in my own way involved or engaged in that, but I'm not really sort of part of much of any community, including those two communities. And I found that it felt like I had really stepped on people's toes, you know, that I had, in ways that I hadn't anticipated. You know, and that there were a lot of, reactions and antagonisms about the piece, especially from those two quarters, I felt. And those were precise, and that the conflicts were, you know, ironically in relation to the parties that I felt most closest to and most engaged with.
Right.
So, it was a difficult, you know, process, the aftermath of it.
Well, I think it created a useful conversation, for sure. And I want to thank you, Daniel, for joining me today to talk about your book. Thank you for joining New Books in Poetry.
Yeah, good. Well, it's been a pleasure. I hope it hasn't been just a kind of echoing what's in that book. But anyway, thank you. I appreciate your interest.
Thanks, Daniel.